Hi, Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from The Cure's Songs of a Lost World. All tracks are written by Robert Smith. Songs of a Lost World was released on 1st of November 2024 on Fiction, Lost, Polydor, Universal and Capital. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya, I'm Tim Burgess and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If you're new to the show, here is where I go through an album with an artist, hearing the stories behind it. I've had loads of great chats so far with guests from Frankie Goes to Hollywood to Nile Rodgers to Elvis Costello. To listen to these episodes, catch up on the Rayo app. Or to find any previous episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter Listening Party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. And check out @Tim_Burgess and @Absolute Radio for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by Robert Smith from The Cure to talk about the band's brand new 14th album, Songs of a Lost World. I could do what I usually do when I introduce each artist. There are so many superlatives I could use to describe Robert Smith and The Cure, but I'm very excited to get into this listening party for The Cure's long-awaited and much-anticipated new album, so I'll keep it brief. It was 2 years ago yesterday that you did a Twitter listening party, I believe.
Was it? 2 years ago?
Yeah,
I remember doing that. I came off stage in Amsterdam, but I always remember, like, there was I did it in the dressing room after the show.
Yeah.
And I was really knackered and they were completely, like, everyone around me was totally out of it, and I was thinking, I've got to do this, like, and I've got to, like, take it seriously. And so I'd prepared that afternoon, I'd written a whole load of stuff out, thinking, like, you know, this is probably what I'm going to be asked, this is what I think. Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll listen to it. So I listened to the album and I wrote down what I thought of it, so I did there. And one of my nephews was there and he was like, oh, I grew up, you're so... How did you think to do that? It's like, yeah. No, it's like, why is Uncle Robert? Is
yeah,
but yeah, I remember it was an unusual thing to do. It was strange, a strange thing to do. Actually,
it's the third most replayed.
The third? Who the hell's? Don't tell me Kylie.
No, no, you'll be surprised. But
Iron Maiden
twice.
Really?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. One and two, and then four is McCartney.
Simon. Our bass player we went to see Iron Maiden 2 weeks ago in Boston. He sent me a message saying, I'm hanging out with Iron Maiden. They think we're really cool.
I think Iron Maiden are really cool. I didn't know anything about them. I think it did like 100,000 listens overnight or something, and just in South America.
Yeah.
Mad. But anyway.
Simon wears an Iron Maiden shirt on every Cure show pretty much, I think. Mainly because of my face just before we're about to go on.
So, I mean, I usually share on Twitter my favourite album of the year, and nobody asks me to do it. And I ask everyone what theirs was. And so it counts as a fully accountable survey, and you'd be glad to know that most people have said that, well, most people who follow me on Twitter agreed that Songs of a Lost World is the best album of 2024.
Blimey.
Yeah.
I don't know how... I am actually struggling a little bit to respond to the amount of love that the band and the album's getting. We're kind of used to it at a lower level. I mean, when we play shows, you know, stuff like there's an engagement with the audience, and it's always really, you know, live shows are always really, really good. But this is kind of different, you know. It's these people who are suddenly saying, you know, this is such a great thing, and I'm just not used to it. If I'm honest, I'm not really used to, you know. I know people around me are very bad at taking compliments, and I sometimes I can lose my temper. I'm like, just take the compliment.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm finding myself in that awkward position where I find it very difficult to take the compliment, because I'm thinking, you know, when it was done, it was finished, and I'd listened. I remember actually listening to it, the mastered version at home for the first time, and thinking like, wow, this is exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
But now I'm starting to think, is it really that good? it's all doubts are creeping in. So it's probably good that I'm moving on to something else.
Do
quick. Because, but yeah, it certainly, I mean, it's not the reason it was created, but it's very gratifying to find that it's touching people in such a way. It's really good.
And on the sleeve notes, I thought it was really beautiful that you just said all those who've been with us through the last 15 years. And I just thought that was like, it just said so much.
Yeah, I mean, when we've been going around the world and playing music to people, there's a genuine sense of community has built up, particularly over the last 15 years. It's always been there with us. I think like the band's represented something quite powerful to people. It attracts, I didn't say a certain type of person, but I think Cure fans do, there's something about Cure fans, which, I mean, every band says we've got the best fans, but I mean, Cure fans, there's something about them, you know, it's like, and it's a real pleasure to play music in a room with people who are Cure fans. We could talk about other bands and they've got like great fans, but it's kind of different. I mean, I've been to lots of shows and so I know what it's like to see other bands. There's a genuine sense of community, and it of course it happens with other bands as well, but when you're part of it you kind of, and it develops and develops and people grow up with you, and like, and particularly after this amount of time, we've still retained a lot of people who were there really, really early on. You know, I mean, I know most of them by name, but we've also attracted like an enormous audience of younger people, and it's when you get in a room with everyone and you start playing music, it's just like it kind of makes sense. So I suppose when it's like to do with an album, because it's been so long since we've had anything new, it's slightly different. It's slightly difficult to, you know. So I was really acknowledging everyone that's kind of like experienced everything with us over, you know, in the time it's taken from the last album to this one, because I think it's the reason why we've kept going, really. I mean, I've wanted to do it, but I wouldn't be able to do it if people didn't want us to do it. So sure, essentially, sure. They're the reason why we're still going.
Did you enjoy Rockfield?
I loved Rockfield, yeah. Yeah,
good, good.
I was saying earlier, it's probably my second favourite time in the studio. I think like nothing could ever beat. We were in a place called Miravel in France in the 80s doing the Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me album. And that was, it had its own vineyard. I mean, it was bought by Angelina and whatever. I can't remember what they're called now. Brangelina, they're called, aren't they?
Brad and Angelina.
Yeah, they bought, is it them? I don't know. Yeah. I'm not very good at this kind of stuff.
Brad Pitt.
They bought it and they still sell their pink wine, their rosé wine, for about 50 quid a bottle. Oh, and like, when we booked the studio, they said you can have free wine if you come and work here, because at the time we were very popular in France. And we said, oh, really? And they rescinded the offer after a week. It said, like, we can't possibly keep giving you this amount of free wine. That was a good month. But Rockfield, in a different way, we created a very sort of very English, although it's in Wales, because it was kind of out, we turned it into our world. And we tried to recreate 1969 in the studio. So it was almost like a weird time capsule.
Yeah.
So leaving there was a wrench. Getting, like walking back into and gave me the idea of the Songs of a Lost World, because I thought it's like we had literally created our own world, you know. For a month we just lived and I had no contact with the outside world. A real kind of like shock returning home. Quite horrible, actually.
And did Kingsley give his seal of approval?
I'm not sure he knew what to make of us. Actually, I mean, he's had a lot of funny people there, but they were good. They're all really nice.
They're great.
Like, you know, they just let us get on with it. We work kind of weird hours and that, but they're used to that. And we're a polite bunch. I think that goes a long way.
They said great things. You know,
the most important people are like the people cooking the food and cleaning for you. Exactly. So the engineers are crucial as well.
It's
a great studio. It's you kind of, when you walk into studios, you feel like other people have done really great stuff there, and so there's no excuse. You know, so.
Was it the Coach House or the Quadrangle or bits of both?
Us, we booked it all.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to, you know, anyone to kind of like wander in. Unannounced. So for the first 3 weeks, we just had we block booked the whole thing. We were playing live shows immediately afterwards because it was early 2019, and we were doing all the festivals. And so we had our live set up in the other studio, and the crew were in that part. So we used to finish recording, then go and rehearse for a couple of hours, or vice versa. So we were actually working two different projects at the same time. So we made use of the whole studio.
I love that.
That's my reasoning.
Well, let's kick off this listening party with the first track from Songs of a Lost World, It's Alone.
This is the end of every song that we sing.
Alone, first track, the first one that everyone heard. Do you think it's catchy?
It would be low down on a list of adjectives if I was describing the song to someone.
Okay.
If you hear it enough times, well, anything's catchy, isn't it? Like a beep is catchy. The one review that I read, because I still read reviews, and it's really stupid, but I sort of like, I'm interested in how people perceive it, I suppose. I think through the medium of reviews, that's how other people are going to perceive it until they hear it themselves. And so I was thinking, that's why I was blind. We were getting 5-star reviews. We've never, ever had 5-star reviews. So I started to read them to see what do they like about this that they haven't liked about anything else we've done. So it's always human nature. So the one bad thing, I was like, you but it's like he can't write tunes anymore. And I thought, it's like gone are the pop hits of like the 80s. I was thinking because that would sound good, wouldn't it? You know, like over and over. I mean, it's like a completely different thing. But it did make me think about you do to some degree sacrifice that kind of earwormy sort of stuff when you're doing emotional big stuff, because it gets in the way. So it's almost not catchy because you don't want it to be too catchy, because it isn't really that kind of music. It's more, it's like asking if a really great piece of orchestral music is catchy. I mean, if you listen to it enough, all joking aside, you know how the next bit is. When I was younger, I used to listen to stuff on repeat, like on a Walkman. I used to have like the same 6 cassettes for a three-week tour and just listen to them endlessly. I knew the tone of the hiss at the beginning and end of the cassette. So everything on those, like it was Astral Weeks. I know every single note on it, but also there was a Gregorian chant cassette, and I knew. I mean, I didn't know what they meant because it's Latin and I don't have the benefit of that kind of education, but I used to sing along, So to me, it was incredibly catchy. And a lot of people would forgetting I had earphones, I'd be sitting there and I'd be singing Gregorian chant. A lot of people think, oh, he's so weird, But I actually thought it's very restful, I was engaged with it. But I'm not sure that Alone's catchy, but I think that there is certainly. There's melody runs through everything The Cure does. There are very few songs that we've done which rely entirely just on kind of like noise, if you like. But I love noise music, which is weird. But I think other people do it far better than I do. So I think what we do best is that is a kind of like a gentle melody of and harmonies and that kind of interweaving stuff. And I think in Alone, when it all comes together like it does in Alone, I think then it becomes, catchy, kind of catchy. Actually, it's not really the right word, but it's catchy enough.
The reason I said that is because I was in Iceland when I bought the record. And I'd heard Alone a couple of times, and Iceland has a lot of spas, right? And I was just in a spa, and it was like ambient music, and I could sing the melody to Alone over this ambient music, and I thought, that is the sign of a really great song.
Yeah.
In my head at that time, that's what I thought. I thought, if I ever get to interview Robert Smith, I'm going to mention that.
Yeah, you could also say that it's like it means it's so incredibly bland that you could like sing it over background music, don't you? It's like
I know what you mean.
I take it in the spirit that you mean. I'm just it's hard to get past visualising you in an Icelandic spa, to be honest, to answer the question properly. If there's a question there, I don't know, I've forgotten.
Okay.
Do you test all new releases?
No, in the same spa. For a start, I've only been to Iceland twice. I wanted to go into a record shop and buy the record, and it's something that I do, and I had it, and but I'd heard Alone as the lead track. I just couldn't stop singing it in Iceland, so maybe it has some sort of connection.
Yeah, it worked, because we started every show from 2022 right the way through to the end of 2023.
Yeah,
it was 90 plus shows. Every show we opened with Alone and we ended with End Song. But that's kind of what you do if you've got when you have a new album out. We've always done that. We always open the show with the lead track from the album. What was weird was that the album wasn't out through that entire period. So we were actually playing, were essentially just like new songs.
But did you have the whole album at this point?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I hadn't sung a convincing version of War Song, actually, was the one I struggled with. I had like different words and it just didn't sound right, but I wanted it to be on the album. I was kind of changing things all the time, all the way through the 2022 tour, actually. We were doing things in soundcheck and I was trying to figure out if we had the right running order and stuff. And I didn't really settle on it until this year. So we were still kind of fluid when we were doing it. And we would drop songs in. We played a lot of songs that didn't make it onto this album. Like we played, which will probably be on the next one because they were recorded at the same time. But I knew that Alone was, you know, it worked just straight away.
Yeah.
Playing songs, which is the opening track and Disintegration, which we did at Troxy in the second set, it's the same kind of thing. It used to allow me to kind of settle into this, like, to take it all in and then to start. And it's almost like a preamble kind of thing. So with Alone, I wanted that, like, that build into the vocal, you know, which became sort of like almost thematic through the album, unintentionally, really. But I wanted the music to breathe before I started singing. And a lot of the initial response from people that I was playing it to was like, you know, is it an instrumental? Because it would be, you know, like 6 minutes and you still haven't sung. It's like, can't you sing a bit earlier? And I'm like, well, why?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a 10-minute song. Why do I have to sing? And I think that's been informed by my love of bands like Mogwai and, you know, God is an Astronaut, and like the bands that are just like essentially instrumental bands, just like who don't need vocals. So I think, right, I need to justify why I'm singing over the top of this, because my intention is really for us to create a great piece of music that fits my words. You know, that's always the goal. And sometimes we pull it off, not always, but when we do, it's like my happiest moment. I think that this is it. And so Alone is one of those. The words just fit with the music, and I think maybe that's it. So in that way, it's catchy, because I suppose the vocal melody that is kind of carrying the song, because there aren't any other strong melodies in the song. And that's true of like most of them on the album, which is why I think the review said that I've lost the art of writing. But I haven't.
You haven't.
Come on.
It's a beautiful opening to And Nothing Is Forever. It's emotional and beautiful, unhurried. I can't think of anything except maybe something classical that affected me so deeply.
That's very nice.
Yeah, and I'm not even a reviewer.
Yeah, when we did that one in the studio, because obviously I was playing it, and I was going to get in a string quartet to play that, and also there's another one that isn't on the album, because it's not supposed to sound like real strings, but it sort of does, because samples are so good nowadays. But you kind of know it isn't.
Yeah.
And I actually liked the idea. So in there is an Emulator 2 string sample. Like, in fact, throughout the whole album, there are old samples from the 80s that we use. Yeah. So I dug out all the old sort of like 8-bit and 16-bit things, and through there's at least one on each track, just to give it a bit of, like, you know, for me it was just a nod to, you know, what we've done in the past.
Well, let's hear that track we've been talking about from Songs of the Lost World. This is And Nothing Is Forever. I mean, people have said that the record is dark, and I think you've said it's depressing, but I think it's very uplifting.
I think I said that about a version of the album which isn't this version of the album.
Okay.
I think it's when I was compiling the album that I left off the most disturbing and depressing song isn't on the album.
Okay.
Because it was too much, and I think that's what I played what I thought was the running order of the album, which was 12 songs, and I think I was referring to that, and I played it to Mary first, like, to see her, gauge her reaction. She was like, you know, you're insane, there's no one who's going to be able to listen to that, like, again. Okay. Listen to it once and that's it, because it's too much, it's too relentless, and it had no light on it at all. So I'm glad she said that, because it made me then think, yeah, I'd actually got too far down this road of thinking I want to make the bleakest, the most depressing. And I thought why do I want to do that? You know, it's like going back to the Disintegration album, which is always held up as, like, you know, this is the album that, like, defines the band. I thought, well, that's got like Lullaby on it and Love Song, Fascination Street. It isn't really a doom and gloom album. It's actually got like hits on it. And I thought, I didn't feel like I wanted to, I thought, I'm not compromising the album by putting like upbeat music on it just so that it isn't difficult. But I also realised that a couple of the songs, it was too long and it was too much. And I figured, like, why don't I go back to try and fit it onto a single vinyl that then became my sort of like starting point. And I redid the whole thing. I knew the beginning song, knew the end song, and then I started to... And Fragile Thing at that point fell onto the album because suddenly it was like, it seemed like a pop song compared to everything else in my dismal state at the time. But that's what I was referring to. I don't think the album is depressing, actually. I think it's emotional, but I don't think it's depressing. It's depressing personally for me because the themes on it are essentially about me dying. So, I mean, it is, it's ultimately is quite depressing, but it's more about enjoying what time you have. I mean, it's the value of time, I think, is at the heart of the album. It's not so much like a doom and gloom woe is me. It's more like I'm much more aware that, you know, and it's not just me, it happens to everyone. You unless you're insane, you become more aware of like how you're spending your time. Time becomes much more valuable the less you have of it.
Nothing you can do but sing, this love is a fragile thing, this love is my everything.
Yeah, it's a bit of a dig at myself. No, I mean, it's something I've been rightly accused of as well. It's just that because there is a certain glibness to, like, you know, that when I've kind of played up to that sort of romantic persona in the past, I do it like, you know, sometimes slightly tongue in cheek. Other times I'm seduced by it. Yeah. Not for a long, long time, but when I was younger, you know. It was kind of harking back to that. It was just me kind of like having a bit of a dig at myself. There's a certain. I'm not sure how I put it. There's a certain dishonesty of youth. You're not really aware of it, but you're kind of like romanticising things, which, and you kind of know you're doing it, but it doesn't seem to matter. But when you get older, it matters more. And so I'm thinking like these things, the things that I value, I don't think I valued them enough when I was younger. And it doesn't bother me because there's nothing I can do about it. I never have regrets because it's a waste of time. But there is very little in my life that I've regretted, thankfully. But there is always that sense that, you know, maybe if, you know, it's just human nature. And I think I was just kind of going back and thinking, like, probably could have done better in certain ways. And that song alludes to the fact, you know, that I haven't always, like, lived up to my own expectation.
Did you look back at, like, earlier Cure stuff before going into this record? I mean, do you ever, I mean, are you...
Only when I'm doing the remasters. And the, we started those in... I think 2010, actually, just after the... Yeah, we did the first album then. I did a flurry of them, I think, for the following sort of 2 or 3 years. I think we got right up to 2004. What am I talking about? 2004 we did it. We did Three Imaginary Boys. I finished in 2010 with Disintegration. Then it all kind of slowed down because we started playing and I just kind of lost interest a little bit in the catalogue. I was doing it really... If I'm honest, I was doing it because they sounded... awful. They were mastered in such a terrible way for CD, the early albums. They never sounded right. And so I liked the opportunity that I was given to kind of make them sound better and put some of the stuff back in with them that I liked, you know, some of the live stuff and the demos and stuff. It was also just a way to re-engage with the past in a more positive way rather than just like sitting and moping and listening to them, oh, the glory is. You know? It was better for me to kind of like address it and think like that, you know. And so I got a good idea over a period of time as to, you know, some things I'm really, really proud of and some things I think are really, really good. But there's a fair bit that I think, like, you know, but we got away with it, I think. Because we were well-intentioned and we were young and it kind of worked and there was always another album coming around the corner. But yeah, there's enough good stuff on there for me to feel like, yeah, I can see why we're still going. And also, there's enough great stuff over a sort of a 30-year period for me to think if we are going to do something new, it has to be really great. No point, you know, we've got all these songs. Why would I want to bring out, a bunch of songs that aren't as good? So... unless I've got something to say, and that's why it took such a long time. And apart from anything else, I just didn't feel the urge to make an album.
Right.
And to me, it's crucial. You know, it's like we could have made an album every couple of years all the way through, you know, since the last one. But what would be the point? You know, so I suppose my idea of making albums has always been like that they need to be driven by this sort of like this urge to create. They're not really there because you're in a band. You're in a band because... that's what you need to do. It's like for too many people, it's the other way around. You kind of like, you come up with a couple of albums and you're in a band. It's like, what do we do now? You've got to make another album. I mean, we did that, if I'm honest. You know, like, I think probably around the time of The Top, the band, it was just like 1984.
That's the first time I saw you.
it just kind of everything fell apart. But I, because I got involved in all other different projects, I kind of I didn't feel like that it mattered. And so, and in a way, that saved the band at that point. You know, Time had left, and I, it was just me left with Lowell and I went off and joined the Banshees for a year or so. And when I came back to The Cure, I kind of think like I sort of missed this, and so I picked it up again. And I think if I'd just pursued it during that period, I think the band would have ended very, very shortly afterwards, because I think I would have kind of thought, well, like, the heart's gone out of it. Whereas I kind of went away and I got rid of all this like, extraneous stuff that was like that I was infected with, and then I came back and I picked up where I'd left off. So
I love that period, the top.
And, yeah, I look back at it with mixed feelings, actually, because I wasn't in a very good physically or mentally in a very good place. But
well, that was the first time I saw the band. 1984 and Manchester Apollo, 17 years old.
That's good funny. I just came across the tape of that recently.
Of Manchester Apollo?
Yeah, because we recorded that tour. So we did that. An album called Concert.
Yeah.
Which we recorded.
Yeah. Black Sleep.
Oxford, Hammersmith, and Manchester.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You might hear me shouting. Yeah. Here's track number 3 on Songs of a Lost World. It's A Fragile.
For all I never was, for all this time alone, has left me hurt, sad and lost. Yeah, every time you leave me is a lie. You make believe you need me, but you try too hard and I feel so wrong. You promise me forever, you say it won't be wrong.
So I saw you at the Troxy, and it's incredible, the sound. Anyone would be forgiven thinking that you did the whole record live from start to finish, because, I mean, you know, the sound coming back is just, it's just like the record.
Cool. I watched it 2 nights ago for the first time.
Yeah.
I watched the stream.
Yeah.
Glad the album doesn't sound like that.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's some great bits in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's different. There's a certain amount of tension on stage which works in some parts, and in other parts it's like, we're kind of teetering on the edge of thinking, I can see me trying, you know, the songs that we've played prior to that show, there were 5 on the album that we've been playing over the last couple of years. Yeah. I know they're going to work. Everyone on stage knows they're going to work, although the first one was a disaster because Simon was wearing some kind of slinky jacket that he'd been given.
Oh, he was kneeling down.
And his bass strap kept slipping.
Got you.
I mean, shouldn't laugh, but I didn't know what was going on because I was just about to start singing and I realised that he was like on his knees behind me, and I thought, like, you know, I could see Reeves kind of like
giving him a helping hand.
I kind of like turn around and say, is everything okay? You know, so I was kind of singing it, and it distracted me. It took me a while to get back into what we were doing, and it's really weird because you think, because there's all part of my brain was thinking, like, what's happening, because I, you know, but from that point on the band sort of grew into the songs. But once we hit War Song, which is the first song that we'd never played before in front of people, suddenly everything felt different on stage. It was not in a good way. There was a real tension there, and it was like, although we'd rehearse it, you know, thinking like, but suddenly here we are, here's people, lights are on, and we're playing the song. And there was a real, you know, I mean, different parts of the band react to that in different ways, and I can never predict how, you know, and watching it back I can kind of see it. I think I'm really into it, but I think so, the band as a band is kind of much more concerned about getting it right.
Do you think that's because it's been filmed and recorded?
Yeah, I didn't tell him it was being filmed or streamed until the week before.
Good tactic.
Just during rehearsals, I kind of just dropped it in that it was a global live stream, and there was this horrible silence. you know, why would you do that? So the tension was released, and particularly in the last song, in End Song, which is a great performance of End Song. It's like it really kind of like it makes sense of the whole set for me. But it was good too. It was more a feeling like when we came off, there was a real sense of, we got through it, you know, rather than when we do a great show, you kind of take the crowd with you and you don't ever think, was it a great show? You just like, you've just been part of something which you've really enjoyed. And that's the side of it which was different. It was a performance in a way that Cure shows aren't really a performance. We're not really aware. And the festivals that we do, I mean, most of them are streamed, but it's not the fact that there's cameras there or anything. It's just that we were playing songs we'd never played before. We were kind of doing something for a very specific reason. And it's a small venue for us. Yeah, I mean, that's not meant to sound
no, not
funny, but I mean, it's much harder to play to people that close. Yeah. I've always found that. I mean, I was so happy when we started to get successful. Because I got such terrible eyesight that when I'm far enough away, I just see like an amorphous mass of people and I feel much more comfortable. If I catch someone's eye when I'm in a smaller show, it's like, it's the end, you know. I start thinking what they're thinking. I start seeing myself through their eyes. I think, oh, God, you know, it's like, it all starts to crumble. But having said that, the trade-off is that it's harder work creating a real sort of like sense of an environment in a bigger venue. It becomes more about the staging and stuff, you know. Whereas the Troxy show was, it was an intimate show. You could kind of feel the crowd. It was good, but there was an expectation there. And I think that's the other thing. There really isn't. People come to a Cure show, they kind of already know. They kind of know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
I don't see much point in what we're going to like. Spring too many surprises. We play songs that we haven't played before, but we're not really going to just break, you know, have a backing singers or dancers and stuff. So people will kind of like know what they're going to get. And there's more to a Cure show than just like what we're doing on stage. I think the Troxy show was more about us. You know, this is our new songs. It was made a lot easier because the response to the album had been so great.
So great, yeah.
You know, the reviews have been, you know, I mean, you can imagine if the album had been panned, it would have been a lot harder going on stage and proving that it wasn't. It would have been a different show. As it was, there was an expectation, like, you know, every review is like, this is a wonderful piece of work. Like, and we're thinking, really? You know, we're going to go on and like, it's all going to go horribly wrong. I'm going to forget all the words and like... But it was good. It was a good night, actually. I'm glad we did it.
It's funny to have those kind of thoughts running through your mind.
I know that I'm not... Yeah, I never... If it's a great show, I never think about it. That's when I know. Because if I ever catch myself thinking about anything on stage, I know that I'm not there.
Yeah, in a weird way.
When you're singing, you know, it's like you're just... The day I have to read the words is that I won't ever reach that day because I'll have given up. I'm singing the songs that I've written and they mean something to me and that's the whole point of singing. Yeah. It's like, so I'm engaged with the song, you know, and I'm trying to present it and I'm engaging with the audience. So when things start to go wrong, and because we haven't been on stage for a long time, you know, a year, we're really in front of people, we've done a couple of BBC sessions, it's not really the same thing. You know, what after a few dates becomes just like you just do things without even, you know, you click pedals and you don't have to look at where you are on the guitar and stuff. All that kind of thing, they're little details. Like when I was watching the stream back, I'm thinking, I'm looking all the time, you know, which I don't normally do. I'm checking, like, am I on the fifth fret? You know, is my hand waiting to go?
Was that
like,
only in the very early beginnings of the live stream, though?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once we got through the first set, the rest of it, it's like totally different. The rest of it is like we've just gone off and taken some really serious drugs. We come back on, it's like everybody knows exactly what they're doing. No, it's just that first hour.
Yeah.
But I suppose that the trade-off is that the intensity that's there on stage with everyone trying... you know, really, really hard not to get it wrong, you know, as opposed to trying to get it right. I mean, we all know what it's supposed to be. So it's more a case of like, can you not just remember what you're playing, but remember how we did, you know, the last couple of days in rehearsal, how did we get to that point where this song became something more than just us playing the chords, you know? So a song like War Song, you just don't, you know, it's all to do with the noise that you're making. And in rehearsal, that was the first time, the night before we had a sound check at Troxy, and it was the first time we really made a noise, you know, with that song. Everyone turned up, you know, and kind of wailed away. And suddenly I thought, like, this is great, you know. It's like, in rehearsal, it just sounds like a series of guitar chords. But suddenly, on the album, you've got this sort of, like, dense kind of, like, build of just, like, it's sort of earth-shaking kind of... like my Mogwai moment. And that's what I was, you know, I was actually thinking, oh God, you know, Stuart's in the audience. Like, Kevin Shields is in the audience. Like, just normally I say to, like, I'm saying to Reeves, like, turn down, you know, and I said, you turn up.
Where did you first meet Reeves?
We're never sure, actually, about this, because Reeves thinks that he met me before. I'm pretty sure, he was in an alternate universe for some of the 90s. So I sang at Bowie's birthday party in New York at the show that he did.
Yeah.
And I met Reeves there. Reeves sort of took me under his wing. We just got on straight away. We have a very similar kind of sense of humour. And we did a rehearsal. So they booked Madison Square Garden for like, I think, 3 days or something. We did a rehearsal. And then I went out with him and I don't remember anything about the next sort of 16 hours. I just remember like going back to the station and Bowie and his band, like, just looking at us, like and I was wearing the same, I mean, I'm always wearing the same clothes, but I mean, I really looked like I was wearing the clothes that I've been wearing the day before. And so, yeah, we bonded straight away. And we did a single called Wrong Number with him after that. And then we just stayed in touch, really. The four-piece band sort of imploded in 2009. And then around 2011, I wanted to get going again. And me and Simon and Jason, we did some things. We rehearsed as a three-piece. We were going to do Best of All as a three-piece.
Yeah.
And then, thankfully, like, sense prevailed, and I realised that we couldn't really play very much as a three-piece. It's all, you know, apart from the early stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Roger came back in, and then that worked really well. But I missed having that guitarist there who could just kind of take some of the load off, so I could go back to singing again. So Reeves is just the obvious choice, you know. Yeah. He's brilliant.
Yeah,
he's which helps. He's like, you know, he's the best guitarist I've ever encountered, and he's got a very dry sense of humour.
Yeah,
and he's got a lot of stories.
Yeah,
in fact, it's hard to shut him up sometimes.
I got lost with him a couple of times when I lived in LA. We were out there at the same time.
Yeah,
it's fun.
He's he spent a lot of time. Obviously, with Bowie and Bowie had kind of the keys to the kingdom pretty much wherever he went. So Reeves is kind of like there as well. Yeah. And so there are some quite funny, unrepeatable stories. Yeah.
This is Warsong on Absolute Radio. Song, harmonium at the beginning.
Yeah,
love a harmonium.
That was a nod to Disintegration. There's a song Disintegration called Untitled.
Yeah, the last track. Yeah,
similar kind of vibe, really. So Warsong, it didn't have a harmonium until this year. It was actually based around a guitar motif, which isn't on the finished song.
Right.
So it's kind of, that song's mutated through various iterations, and I wanted it to sound Scottish. Actually, I wanted it to sound like an army coming over, like marching over, like that sort of like a kind of cinematic sort of thing. And then the problem with the harmonium is there's always a small part of me that thinks I have a cutler.
Yeah.
Which sort of undermines any sort of like grandeur that you like. So once I got past that, I thought it's nice. There is something about, I've got a harmonium at home, and it's like, and it's my favourite instrument. It's always been my favourite instrument. There's always been a harmonium in our house, like when I was growing up. And it's just holding down, just like.
Yeah. And then, the bass is like ferocious and affected. And who's doing this? It's like a Hendrixy kind of thing. Is that you or is that Reeves?
That's Reeves.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I could pretend that's me, but I wouldn't get away with it for long.
You could pretend for a minute.
Yeah. Letting Reeves off the leash on a couple of these songs is that actually it adds a dimension to the band, which is, it's an unexpected part, and that's probably what isn't there on some of the other albums. When Paul was playing, and Paul was a great guitarist, but I wouldn't really let him do what he wanted to for a long, long time because it was at odds with what we did.
Yeah, because he was in very early.
Yeah,
show, wasn't
yeah, he? In and out of the band for over a period of like 20-odd years. Because when we started out, Paul was in, before we actually changed our name to The Cure, Paul was in the band.
Yeah.
And was like the local lead guitar hero kind of thing. And it didn't really work.
Yeah.
And also, punk was against all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and I was like, I thought, unless there's a reason for it, like, please don't play a guitar solo. I think Reeves has spent so much of his career playing, particularly with Bowie, kind of stepping back, metaphorically. When Bowie opens his mouth, you're not really going to start playing lead guitar. You're not going to last very long if you do. And so it's kind of inbuilt with Ruse. And like he looks at me, and if I, and like, and we've developed an understanding, particularly on stage. Like if I wanted to go a bit more, you know, go for it, I'm just like, you know, there's a kind of go for it look, and he's like, ah, and he goes for it. But he understands that the band isn't about that. You know, it's not. Yeah, you know, he's got his own kind of experimental trio where he's able to do that. He understands that the song is, like I said earlier, the song is the key. And so on Warsong, I just wanted him to kind of go a bit sort of Hendrixy and stuff. He doesn't like it when I say things like that. He's always like, because he's very, very aware of being his own.
I think he
has developed his own style. But the problem is that what people would say is Reeve's style, I think, up until he's been in The Cure for quite a long time, whereas I think I've beaten it out of him.
Right.
He's constant vibratoing, you know, and they say, right, don't stop doing that. You know? Which is a bit silly because that's kind of what he was known for. But he's an experimental guitarist at heart. He's much more about sounds than melody and stuff. You know, although he can play absolutely anything, left to his own devices, he just makes noise. You know, if he's on his own in the rehearsal room, you can hear like squealing and shrieking. You know, it's Reeves like testing out and, you know, like a much needed new pedal because he's only got about 48 on his board. So.
Wow.
How dare I say things against Reeves? This is outrageous.
Him and Kevin with their pedals.
Yeah, because I'm there with my six Boss pedals that have been there for like 30 years. Can I interest you in this pedal? You tell me? No, it's okay.
So that's the end of side one. Was it always going to be the end of side one?
Yes, it was. Warsong, yeah. Warsong was actually the trickiest song to finish of all of them because I wanted to sort of be commenting on the parlous state of the world, but at the same time, the intention of the song was it was written about a relationship that I had, which was kind of soured horribly, and then was okay again, and then it soured again. And I thought, like, God, it's just like it's you never really know why. Yeah. It kind of used to drive me a bit crazy, and I just see it around. I see it with people around me as well, and I think, like, you know, you can kind of see it when it's happened to other people, but you can never understand when it happens to you. So it was that. But then I thankfully kind of sort of moved it out into the world a little bit and it was just more, it's more about, like, you know, particularly the male desire just to fight. It just I'm now old enough, you know, you've kind of seen it all before. It's so tragic, the sort of repeating history, all the same mistakes by the same people just with different names. It's really wearying and also quite worrying at times.
Yeah.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
So, Robert, drone, no drone? I think when I heard it, and you just saying before that, you know, that well, you didn't say that you repeat yourself, but along those lines.
Yeah, you did.
Okay, I did.
Yeah.
But I kind of thought of Head on the Door with this song.
Really?
Yeah. Side two, specifically.
Right.
But, you know, that's not meant to be a...
No, I think it's kind of like Fascination Street in my mind.
Oh, right.
Okay. It sort of occupies the same place in the album, if you like. It's just not musically, but it has like an energy to it. It's got a distorted bass line. It's kind of a bit relentless. It suddenly lifts everything up. And I think that's what, from what I was saying earlier about my original Running Order, didn't have that song on it either. It hadn't, you know, because I thought it was much too poppy.
I was maybe thinking like... Yeah.
You're thinking of the song that goes down, 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 da 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 da.
Maybe, yeah. Is that sinking? Is that one? No, Screw. Screw.
Screw.
Maybe that, but I mean, I don't know. It's just a vibe.
Yeah. Well, same bass player, isn't it?
Same bass player.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was trying to get some of what you see when Simon's playing on stage, the energy that he's got, and that
it's
sort
amazing.
Of like relentless sort of like, I wanted to get a song on the album that has that, and that's the song, Drone's the song, that's got that kind of like relentlessness to it, which is just there, you know, from beginning to end. It was the hardest song to mix of all the songs on the album, to get it actually to sound like, it's a real delicate balance for it not to sound like rock.
Yeah,
you know, with a capital R.
Yeah.
But it was good fun actually doing that live for the first time. I enjoyed that very much more than I thought I would. Warsong was more difficult, funny enough, even though it's a much simpler song. Much more difficult to step up to the mic and sing it properly.
Okay.
But it's probably the best vocal that I did at Troxy. I think it's the best performance. And the third song, All I Ever Am, which we'll get to, turned out to be the hardest one to pull off live for a number of reasons. It's like technically much harder than the others and rhythmically more difficult and far too many notes for me to remember what I was thinking. I watched the stream and I thought it's, you know, I remixed it. I remixed the album set.
Yeah.
So it's coming out as on December the 13th, actually.
Oh, great.
To benefit War Child. So I thought I'm not going to do it as a vanity project. I'll do it and some good will come of it. So, yeah, I wanted it to be just like exist physically. I mean, it's staying up on Space Tube for however long, I don't know. Which has gone down really well, the fact that we did that and like did it for nothing. People can't believe that there's no adverts on it.
It's great.
I mean, it's like driving the point home that not everything has to be monetized and it still works. It's now a couple of million people watch it and feel good about having watched it. It's like, and how can I not feel happy about it? I felt that the mix, because Corky was doing it, was mixing it primarily for the room, because that's what he was doing, because it matters what the people in the room, it matters to us on stage how it sounds and how the people in the room react. So there are certain parts of the mix which are, you know, he mixed the album, but he said to me afterwards, I've had to compromise certain aspects of what you're doing because the room hasn't allowed me to, you know. Because he was saying to me, shall I mix for the live stream? Shall I put headphones? And I was like, no, because they're not here. You know, that's also another reason why it was free, because I thought if it does sound rubbish, no one's going to complain, are they? My free stream didn't sound really good. I've sat and listened to it at home and I thought, my interpretation of it is it's not like it doesn't sound like the album. It sounds like I hear us on stage. So it's a slightly different version again of what we're doing. But in some ways it's a vanity project because I thought, well, I just want it to exist, you know, when things are just online only and they never feel like they're quite real. Yeah. I want a vinyl in my hand.
Will it be the whole gig or just the new album?
Just that set. I think Nick Wickham, who filmed it, who did the Meltdown thing with us a few years back, he did film the whole thing, obviously because it was streamed, so he recorded everything. Yeah. It's just, I have to think about whether it's, it's quite a lot of time, apart from anything else, is spent when you undertake a project like that to get it to its completion, to make it look really good. But he's adamant that there's, you know, he's got like 16 kind of cameras, I think, in total filming at various points in the show. So he's adamant that it will, you know, it could look great. And I suppose the idea of doing the show and mixing it in surround sound or Atmos, you know, and releasing it as a Blu-ray or something is a kind of commemorative idea. Mm-hmm. It honestly just depends whether I think it's good enough. I don't, you know, we've the Hyde Park thing that we did in 2018, and which was was released with the show that we did at the Meltdown Festival. It was pretty definitive, and then unless there's a good, you know, this is a different lineup. I mean, obviously Perry's on stage and we're playing different songs, but so I have no hesitation in the opening set in the new album set. But you can't really just have that on a Blu-ray. It's a bit of a cop out. I mean, because if you think of where's the rest of the show, and actually some of the rest of the show was really really good. So it's just that it's the same songs though. You know, there's not really that, apart from Secrets. There's not really that much different on it. It's a good version of A Forest though, I have to say.
Amazing.
It's like it's really really like one of the. There's something about it. It's a really, I think because we did that just that little 17-second album segment.
Yeah, yeah.
And me and Simon looked at each other at the start of it and almost felt like we'd gone back to like 1979. It was really was a powerful kind of 20, 25 minutes on stage. It was good.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that was unexpected for me anyway.
Yeah, it was for us. I mean, it was. That's why Reeves hadn't learned the solo. I just said, just play something in B. It's all right. He's going, really? And the song's like, it's B minor. But
does that still work or not?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of, but Cure fans will, you know, they'll expect the solo. You know, I'll play the solo. And I said, like, don't, just play, you know.
Yeah.
So we literally just rehearsed it on the last day of rehearsals. Because it came to me that it was an anniversary of me and Simon playing for the first time on stage together. So I thought, let's do just a little sort of like, you know, a little mini concert in the middle of the other concert. And
I like it when you come back on and you kind of like, it looked like you've just decided what you're going to do just before you walked on the stage.
Yeah, those days are gone though, because there's too many people involved now for me to do that. I often have alternative lists written up.
Okay.
But I always have to decide before we actually walk out on stage. It's very. I still do. I still throw in things, you know, and then like everyone runs around
like
the
tour, chicken, or
like the lights. I'm like, you know, come on. In the old days, you just like used to make it up every single song. I just throw, you know. But I felt I probably had to keep this one under control because it was being filmed. I thought I can't really do it, you know. So I had this idea that we might do. We might finish with some Three Imaginary Boys songs, which we probably would have done, but we ran out of time.
Yeah.
So we had those on the list as well. So I thought that would kind of be nice going back to the beginning and stuff. Yeah. But it all gets a bit maudlin, though. You know, I thought the whole night was supposed to be about the opening set, and really that's what I want. Yeah. Once we'd done that, and I thought that we did that well. The rest of the night was pretty much just like a bit of a bean feast, really.
Yeah,
it's like,
great.
Yeah. Although, you know. Playing songs like Disintegration, playing songs like Bean Feast music, is it? You know what I mean?
Let's hear the fifth song on the album, Drone, No Drone. Track number five on Songs of a Lost World, Drone, No Drone, you know, listening to the record at the Troxy. It was just like really evident. And me and my mate were just sitting there going, oh, the choice of notes. Like, you know, you're just playing along and then the choice of notes are just like so just interesting. I mean, you know, it sounds such a lame thing to say, but how can you tell me what I'm trying to say?
That is the most difficult question I've ever been asked.
So it's like, you know, you just like, nothing is expected. And I love that. Everything just seems so considered, but like, you know, so relaxed. And so I like to write songs and I like to always make the third chord or something like that. Not what you would expect after hearing the first and the second one.
Yeah.
Just for my own interest and also just to see where, you know, see what opens up after that. And I thought that the choice of notes in each song were just unexpected.
The new songs?
The new songs, yeah, the first set.
I think there's, after this length of time, I mean, I'm acutely aware of not repeating myself. And despite that, I repeat myself.
Yeah.
I mean, but there are only a certain number of subjects which motivate me to write words. And there's only a certain... Although we've dabbled with lots of different styles over the years, you know, we've done kind of like some strange stuff, but essentially the heart of the band, there is a kind of like, for me, a Cure sound, and a lot of it is, I actually think it's quite predictable. It's the way you interpret that predictability. If I'm awaiting the third chord and I know what I want and it doesn't happen, I think I'm kind of like, don't be so clever. I mean, that's like prog rock. You know, you're like, come on. It's much better to satisfy the customer in that sense. But it's a way of finding different ways of saying the same thing.
Right.
I've kind of like, and that's actually like part of the struggle with getting anything completed for me, because I think I've done that before and I've done it better. And I don't, you know, and what's the point in doing it again? You know, so it reminds me of a conversation when Reeves joined the band, like provisionally in 2012 and then just stayed. we would have long discussions, like particularly on the 2016 tour. It was the first time I'd spent a long period of time with him, you know, on a tour bus, and we talked about pretty much everything. But part of the conversation was always, because his background is completely different musically, where he grew up and the music he listens to and how he learned to play guitar and everything else, utterly different. And he was really intrigued by how I play guitar, because he didn't figure out, like, you know, how did I play guitar? Like, I learned piano and then I learned classical guitar, and I never really kind of learned, was shown how to play guitar. I kind of learned myself, but I already knew how to read music. And kind of, so I was kind of like, I was educated to a point. I almost unlearned everything in order to play punk music. Because that's what I started playing. Although I learnt Jimi Hendrix songs and stuff. And like, so I learnt very strange fingerings. And then I listened to Nick Drake. My brother used to say to me, "You're never going to play that. You have to detune it." And I was like, "What?" You know, I can actually remember the moment when I realised that I didn't have to stay in normal tuning. And I detuned the guitar and started playing. Think, "Oh my God." And, like, and then suddenly, like, you're hitting Neil Young chords and things. It's like, so this whole world opens up. And you think, "Well, these are essentially the same chords, but they sound completely different." And I think that's what informed me all the way through and still does. There's that sense of like interplay between essentially the same 13 notes, if you like. Yeah. But for Reeves, he comes at it in a, you know, he went to music college and like, and it's a very much more cerebral attitude he has. And it's like, and also he's able to play anything he can think of. And I can't. I can think of lots and lots of things I can't play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In fact, most of what I think of, I can't play. So I think I approach what we do as someone who's writing words and that are going to be sung along with a piece of music. So it's like the whole thing. So I don't think of myself as a guitarist or as a singer or as a songwriter. I'm kind of like, I'm in a band and I'm the primary songwriter in the band and I'm going to end up singing the song. So if something's a bit odd and I enjoy it, I don't second guess whether other people will like it. That's the key to it, I think.
Yeah.
So if it's predictable, but I think it's good, it stays. But if it's predictable and it's predictable and it isn't that good, it doesn't stay, you know, it doesn't get a look in. So I think it benefits me having other people in the band through the years who always come along with something slightly left field.
Yeah.
And then I have to write words to it because I've always liked to, you know, like Simon always comes up with something that's really like hooky and catchy and that's usually the single, you know, in the past. And Roger will come up with something that's a bit more sort of like jazzy or something, a bit more sort of like the timing's a bit weird, and Jason will do the same. Can't we do something in 7/8? And everyone's like, "Why? We don't want to spend 6 minutes playing 7/8. It's like you have to think too much."
So all these things
feed in, but essentially the heart of it is the idea that the songs are really what the band has always been about. And I think that there's no reason to be unpredictable unless it benefits the song. That's the short answer.
I'm glad I asked the question. Robert, up next is I Can Never Say Goodbye.
Yeah, that's that's the most difficult song to perform for me, and it was the most difficult song for me to sing, actually, just to record the vocals. So I did all the vocals at home for the first time ever. I sang everything in the studio, but I ended up doing everything again at home.
Yeah.
And it took me ages to get that vocal right because it was my brother died, and when I got home, I wrote that piece of music. That was my response to it, and then I struggled for a long time to find the right set of words to kind of that weren't too overwrought, but that actually had enough kind of gravitas in it to express what I really felt. But it's difficult, and you know, it's not the sort of thing you think about. You know, what will I do when this happens? You never really, you shouldn't really think about it, because otherwise your response wouldn't be honest. And but it was a shock. You know, it was wasn't expecting him to die, and it was a real much more of a shock than I thought it would be, actually. More of a shock than my mum and dad dying, funny enough. Not funny enough, because he was just closer to me in many ways than in age. So yeah, I wanted to sort of do it justice. I wanted to create a song that I thought he would like.
Yeah.
But yeah, it helps me singing that song through the touring period, through 2022 and 2023. I kind of came to terms with it every night, you know. And Simon's brother died as well. One of his older brothers died. So it's very, people throw the word cathartic around a lot and meaninglessly, but it was, particularly in the initial phases, it was really good. And I say that, it was really good. It made me feel better about things and also connected with a lot of people, you know, because our generation who've grown up with us are experiencing the same things.
Yeah.
People are experiencing it all the time, you know. It's silly, really, for me to fixate on it because it's like nothing unusual. But I suppose that's the point. You know, I'm trying to the art, I think, of writing a good song is taking something that's personal and making it universal, like appealing to people. Sometimes it's trite, you know, and I suppose the art of it is to push through that. You know, so my initial versions of that song were really just awful. Too raw and just too woe is me, I suppose. And that's always the problem I think you have with expressing grief creatively, is that the reality of it is that like that person has died, but and you're left behind, and you're like, and but everything's kind of centered around you, and yet it's that person that's died. And it was when you see it happening to other people again, it's one of those things you think, oh, come on, you know, you're still here. And there's always that, like, you know, get hold of yourself kind of thing. But when you're in the midst of it and it's happening to you, it's very difficult to see that light. You know, you're just like, it's a crushing kind of sense. And it's essentially to do with your own mortality. I mean, obviously, it's like, if your brother dies, it's like, it's very close to home. But it's also, it's something's been torn away from you. Something's been torn out of your life. And however much you think about it, the reality of death is a very... It's a difficult thing to cope with, you know, being with someone when they die is a difficult experience. And I struggled with the idea of it being something that I should write a song about, if I'm honest.
But that was your natural response, right?
The music was.
Yeah.
But the words were just an outpouring of just like, you know, because I just do that anyway because it's easier than, you know, it's either that or I walk outside and shout. But yeah, I just, you know, I struggled for a while to accept that I should turn it into a song. I know of other people that have expressed these reservations as well about writing about things which are, you know, there's a trade-off between you memorialising someone or something and accepting what's happened and being able to, and dealing with it, I suppose, in some way, and trivialising it. And it's actually quite difficult to, you know, it's just suddenly it's like there, it's now, it's just a song, you know, it just turns into a song. But going out on stage and singing it every night, it was very much like it was the first time I was singing it. And so I kept that part of, you know, I treated it on stage as something very different to the rest of this of the show.
Quite separate in a way.
And the band always felt that as well. Yeah, everyone was like, the mood of the band is often quite, on stage, you know, things go on and it's like, you look at each other and stuff goes on and you know, it's not playful exactly, but there's an undercurrent sometimes of, you know, things that you've seen or like, or what's something that's just happened and no one else is noticing. The mood would change for that song.
Right.
It would become very, very serious. Very somber, whatever else was going on, just for that sort of 6 or 7 minutes, it would be a very sort of somber, dramatic kind of thing.
That's I Can Never Say Goodbye from the New Cure album, Songs of a Lost World. Do you think, like, everyone in the band's listening to the words as well and sort of, like, thinking, focusing on, you know, how to make sure that... I mean, because, you know, the words are so open and, you know, yeah. so beautiful.
Well, they don't...
I mean, not in trepidation. I mean, just, like, but kind of, like, just making sure that it, you know, just comes across... You know, for you.
Yeah, everyone has me. Everyone listens to me on stage, apart from Simon.
Of course,
Simon runs about. So Simon hears me by default because he's hearing everyone. I mean, half the band wearing ears, and half the band are on monitors. So there's enough of me there in the air.
Okay.
To you know, but yeah, the band responds to. I mean, but I sing in rehearsals. Do that. I mean, I'll say to them, look, this is the bit where you got. You know, so you don't have to listen to like every, you know, verse two. But honestly, when I get to the, like, the, you know, I mean, I'm saying this, I'm thinking about, like, Friday, when we did Friday, I'm in love with Choxie, and I went horribly wrong, but it's like, I thought we were so close that I just relaxed ever so slightly, and it all went.
Everyone loves
wrong.
That, though, don't they, when something goes a bit wrong? Everyone in the audience.
But that was
it.
A good example of, like, so half the band followed, like, watching the stream, it's really interesting, because half the band follows what I'm singing, and the other half of the band just carry on playing the song, thinking, an idiot, he's gone wrong, you know, so. If you watch very carefully, you can see who's listening to me and who isn't. But yeah, ultimately I prevail because I'm just thinking like you can't really stop singing. Like, I've reached the middle eight. You have to catch up. So the others know that the response, you know, the emotional response that you get with a song. I mean, a lot of it. I mean, instrumental music creates an emotional response, a very strong emotional response. In fact, my preferred music is instrumental music. But I also know that for whatever reason, when I sing, people connect with it. And, and it's one of those things, I have no idea why, and I don't think any singer does. It, like, lots of people sing. Most people can sing. You know, not many people want to get up in front of people and sing. I didn't ever want to get up in front of people and sing. I was horrified when I ended up as the singer. You know, I honestly, like at school, I never did anything on stage. I was always doing wardrobe stuff, you know. The last thing in the world I wanted was to get on stage. And even when we did our first shows, I sang one song at our first show just to see what it felt like. And I sang the wrong song. You know, and I played, we were doing covers. I played and sang Suffragette City and everyone else was doing Foxy Lady. And yeah. I was so drunk, I didn't even know. It's like, I thought that was good. You know, and it was like, you played the wrong song. I never felt like I was cut out to be a singer, and I kind of just grew into it because I fell out with everyone else that sort of occupied that position until I became the de facto singer. You know, it's like, and I was all, you know, that's why the early albums, the early mixes, I'm really low down in the mix, almost, you know, because I was unsure about what I was doing and what, and I didn't have the right kind of mental, I didn't have the big enough ego, actually, looking back, to be a singer. It's you know, because you do have to like think like, oh, you walk out on stage. And I mean, I've kind of developed it, I've grown into it, but there's always a part of me which is like wonders, you know, when I'm walking up onto a stage, like, really? I mean, I still honestly think that. I'm like, what am I doing? So it's not a question of being shy. I've never been shy, but I've never been extrovert. And to be a singer, there has to be a part of you which really wants, you know, craves attention. And it's lovely when it works. But when I started singing, I didn't think that anyone would like what I sounded like. I didn't. And so I thought, well, no one else is going to. And so I thought, well, this is going to be a really short career until we find someone who can sing. So I sang the first album and then discovered that people liked what I was doing. And as it develops and people become, you know, they feel like they start to know you, and they, and like, you're, if you're writing like relatable words and you feel, and people feel like you're singing with honesty, and like, then you become part of their lives. And ultimately, you know, your voice actually resonates with people in a way that another instrument doesn't. So the band knows that. They know that if I'm singing well to an audience, it's an extra thing, you know. Mm. It's like, so the instrumental build-up in the songs, it's not like you're waiting for me to start singing, but the singing bit comes and it's adding to what we've already created. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, so yeah, they listen, but some listen more than others.
I mean, everyone has been saying, you know, that your voice has never sounded better.
Hmm. I have no idea how this is possible. It's just genes. I mean, my dad was singing until he was in his 90s.
But it's nuts, isn't it? Because, like, lots of singers, you know, lose their voice quite early on, and some, I mean...
I'm just getting asked, like, what do you do to keep your voice in such good and stuff? I said, like, I have pretty much done everything I can to have killed myself in the last 50 years. So, like, keeping my voice in good nick has really been low down on my list of priorities. So, I honestly, it's just genetics. It's as simple as that. I mean, I don't do anything at all. I mean, I don't live the same life as I did when I was, you know, 20 years ago. But I never worried about not being able to sing. I've never had to drop a song in key and things like that. But at some point I will.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know...
That's okay.
Something mystical. It is gonna happen. But, I'm just lucky, I suppose. I gave up smoking quite a long time ago. Yeah. I think that's probably the reason why. I think that's what... I mean, I was going to say it's what kills you. I mean, it does, but it also kills your voice. But,
yeah.
Yeah. So clean living and religion.
Well, of course. Of course. Let's play the next song. This is called... All I Ever Asked.
To me, as well, but lyrically, this one's slightly different to the rest of the songs. It was the most difficult. So I can never say goodbye was difficult because I wanted it to have a certain tone, and I found it really, really difficult to get the right tone that I was going to sing, and for it to be honest and to be plaintive enough to come across as being real. And All I Ever Am with such a contrived subject in a way, and so kind of like up its own arse, that I was worried that I was writing a song about something which was, on the one hand, so patently obvious, and the other hand, like something that you shouldn't even really be bothered thinking about. And yet, like, reams and reams of books have been written about the subject of the persistence of consciousness and so forth. And in a period of my life, I was really intrigued by it, by how we are like the sum of who we were, kind of thing, and all that sort of stuff. And whether we're aware of it, or whether, you know, or whether there is a persistence of like of consciousness, or whether, you know, who am I, the same person, or, you know, in not just in a literal sense, not in a physical sense, but like emotionally and mentally. I think, well, of course not, because you change, but then it leads you down. It's like, how much do you change? You know, like your formative part of your life, which is essentially, you know, when you're like 3 years old to kind of, you know, a certain, depending on who you believe, like sort of 3 to 7, but I think work goes further on. And I really think, you know, right the way through until you're in your like early 20s, you're not really you. I don't think you don't really become. And yet, there is when you look back, there is a certain part of your life, certain parts of your life, which feel much more you than anything that follows. It's a strange. It's that really that it doesn't bother me. I don't sort of wander around, like, agonising over it, but from time to time I think, like, I do something or I say something, I think, that wasn't me. And I mean, and everyone does it. It's like, people will say, that doesn't sound like you.
Yeah.
And you think, like, what does that mean? How do you mean it doesn't sound like me? And it's like, so it's like, and it's also, I suppose, there's an element to it as well, which is because of what I do, because I do feel like I present myself in, like, and there's a public face to me, which is kind of odd. Most people don't do that.
Mm.
They don't have a performing side to them. They don't, you know, certainly don't, you know, wear makeup, go on stage and sing.
Makes me think of your videos now, though, and sort of like, you know, getting into in the 80s, getting into like characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because part of it is you want to mess around because you don't take it as seriously as, you know, as maybe others do or something like that. Or
there's also a part of it where you, and people say, like, why do you wear makeup? And I say, well, because when I put my makeup on, I still do. I feel like I'm about to do something which is like not normal, which is like not necessarily abnormal, but if there was another word for not normal, out of the ordinary, and not really part of who I am.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's like if you, but it's like thousands of years old. You go out on a stage and you generally try to, like, you're enhancing your features, or you're creating some kind of mask, or you're doing, you know, it's something. It's theatrical. It's a performance. And it's that side of it as well, which that feeds into the song, like, All I Ever Am, because it's like I say about the empty stage and stuff. It is a much bigger part of my life than I realised it was.
Right.
Performing has actually become something which is integral to who I am as an older man. And it's odd, because I didn't even really think about it. It just sort of happened. And I'm thinking, like, when did this happen? So it's that kind of self-reflection, but again, like I said, there's a danger of it becoming like, it's like it's solipsistic. It's like, you know, like, here I am, like, worrying about it. It's like, and the world's on fire, you know. It almost doesn't matter. And yet it kind of does, because it informs everything you do, everything you say, everything you know, all your actions are informed by, like, what your sense of right and wrong. And it's really all tied in with that sense of identity. And so it was, and I thought it'd be interesting just to see if I could write a song about it without sounding sort of kind of, because I don't really know that I've reached a conclusion in it at all. I have no idea, really. It was almost, I had even when I was writing it, I had to keep rereading it, because I've got like double negatives in it that sort of, I was thinking, this doesn't make any sense. And I'm still not sure if it does. So it was an interesting thing to write about. And I thought I just needed a couple of songs. I'm wary of when I do this, though, because I've done it before and write songs about subjects that interest me, and they often turn out, they're so, I think, that's really good, and it's like very well constructed and so forth, blah, 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 but it doesn't engage with people.
Right.
And the songs very quickly drop out of a set list, and people, they're no one's favourite songs. And I thought, I don't really want that song, you know, on the album. But again, I managed to get it to a point where it kind of sets you up for the end song, because it's like me struggling with who I am, and which is essentially what End Song is all about.
Except
End Song is a kind of an emotional response to the feeling of growing old. All I Ever Am is an emotional response to the idea of being young. It's kind of like the flip side of it. I'm
outside in the dark. Here's the 10th and final track on Songs of a Lost World, the epic End Song. with End Song, you know, what happened to that boy? You know, it was thinking about, you know, three imaginary boys, Boys Don't Cry. It's that, right?
Yeah, and it's weird playing, like, we finished the show with Boys Don't Cry. I mean, it's almost become like, you know, we sort of do it. And I still think, when I'm singing it, I still think that's me, yeah, going back to it. I can still feel myself in that song. It's like, so, it's almost like, I mean, not just music, but art in general, like, it has that power to kind of pull you out of yourself and to take you into other places. And when you're actually singing and you feel that happening, it's like, just on a really selfish level, it's a great feeling, because I think I'm getting away with this,
yeah, you know.
but End Song is really, because we recorded in 2019. It was the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, which I was obsessed with as a kid. You know, I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to be a footballer, but then if I couldn't do that, I wanted to be an astronaut. I thought it was kind of like, well, if I fail at football, I'll be an astronaut, because that's the way it looked like the world was going. You know, how wrong was I? But I remember, like, standing outside with all the family, like, looking at my dad saying, yeah, they're walking on the moon. And I can remember my feeling of utter disbelief. You know, thinking like that, it's not, you know, and being left alone in the garden looking at it and thinking like, a very early conspiracist, and seeing it on the telly, seeing all that, like the grainy black and white images and stuff, and it's represented so much, that the moon landing, it was like an incredible event, and the sense of the sort of optimism about everything, the possibilities of, like, were, you know, immense. I used to look up at the sky and thinking, I'm gonna go to the moon. I've often written that line, in different forms, and it represented the desire to, you know, just like do whatever you wanted, kind of like, you know, follow your dreams.
Yeah.
But it was real, you know, it was a real possibility that I was going to grow up and be an astronaut. It wasn't just like a pipe dream. I thought, yeah, you know, my daddy says, well, you have to do science, you know, and it was a dead serious kind of like, but it didn't work out. Although I have been to the moon several times.
Yeah, me too.
When we were recording 2019, the album, the working title was Live from the Moon, and we recreated 1969 in the studio, so there was no modern technology allowed in the studio, and we had all 1969 stuff, magazines and newspapers and toys and board games and you know, Apollo board game, fantastic game. Particularly with a few pints of Welsh beer in
here. Yeah.
How have we not played this more in the last 50 years? So, yeah, it was for a month, we just created that sort of vibe of, which is why it was Songs of a Lost World. Because when I left the studio, I felt like I realised that world, the world that we'd created in Rockfield no longer existed, and the world that actually I was celebrating no longer existed. And it was, again, the persistence of the world itself. You know, you're thinking, like, everything's the same, but it isn't. It's just like, it's a strange feeling. I mean, because our time scales are so tiny. Ever since the moon landing, I've had a telescope, and so I'm kind of, you know, I love nothing more than just like spending a few hours just staring at the space. It does give you a sense of perspective, and the time scales that we work to and that everyone is obsessed by become, you know, I mean, I don't own a lot of technology for that reason, because I find it really, really irritating, because it drags me back into a world that I don't really want to be in. So I've never owned a smartphone, for example, because I can't really be bothered with it, you know. I thought I lived for quite a long time without a smartphone, so I don't really see why I need one. And I don't have an assistant who has one either before it's an it's unnecessary, you know, and it kind of like, I feel like it's a step too far for me, just personally. Like, and I like to, you know. So in some ways, I've sort of stopped at a certain point. I've chosen to stop at a certain point, right, and I've kind of disengaged with the modern world to a degree. Although I am Luddite, actually, in the truest sense, because I despair at the blindness of walking into an AI world. It's just like, it drives me crazy, but. I've always been kept abreast of technology, but I've never really been seduced by it. So I understand how it all works, but to me, when people talk about sexy tech, there's nothing worse. I mean, I suppose that's informed a lot of what we've done over the years as well, and particularly with this album, I think it's come to like a point where I've actually like wanted the band to create something which celebrates a world which sadly is not no longer there, but without becoming too sort of like I said earlier, too maudlin about it and too morose. But you know, I'm glad that I think I've experienced a better world than the youngsters that I know. Right. I think it was a lot easier and a lot brighter. But then you just sound like your dad. You know? It was better.
Well, there is that.
My dad never said that because he went through a world war. So he never used that line on me because he had to go away and fight for 5 years. So the world he grew up in wasn't the best of all possible worlds. So he used to say to me, "You're living in the best of all possible worlds." Right. So, and I believed him, and I think he was probably right.
I think so too. Thanks, Robert. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Smith for joining me on this episode of My Listening Party to tell me all about the new Cure album, Songs of a Lost World, which is out now.
And don't forget, Cure's Songs of a Live World, an incredible set recorded at Troxy in London, is out on December 13th, and all the royalties from the album go to War Child.
Anyone who's heard the show before knows that at this point I like to tell you about what other music I've been listening to recently. What have I been listening to? Why would I recommend it? Sophie Pyer's Silent Stories. It's beautiful. I saw her play. I had a really great view of her hands while she was playing the piano in Iceland. I was on a balcony of a church. Front row stuff. And it was just mesmerizing, incredible. I have no idea how old she is, but I would imagine she was like early 20s and just like so amazing, so flipping amazing. So I introduced myself, told her I was her newest fan, and just been listening to that record since I got back from Iceland, really. I have also been listening to test pressings of The Listening Party Volume 2, which is coming out very soon on Demon Records. The Listening Party Volume 2 has tracks by Paul McCartney, Hot Chip, Michael Kiwanuka, Run the Jewels, Roisin Murphy, Iron Maiden. And I thought, for that alone, it would please Robert in his love of Iron Maiden. So, there you go. I did a listening party in Iceland with Sigur Rós, and it's the Brackets album. And I really, really loved it and really loved the experience in Iceland. So I've been listening to that a lot since I got back. Hopefully we'll get a listening party soon. I've been listening to the Charlie XCX album. It's very good. And I think it's pretty impressive what she's doing. So, been listening to that. A bit late to the game, but I'm fully in now. I'm having a brat winter. And while we're talking about recommendations, why don't you recommend this show to a friend? Tell them to replay any previous listening party by just searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There's episodes with Fall Out Boy, Tears for Fears, Simple Minds, and so many more. Every song in this episode of My Listening Party was taken from The Cure's Songs of a Lost World. All tracks are written by Robert Smith. The album was released on Fiction, Lost, Polydor, Universal, and Capitol in November 2024. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.